Chapter 12. In November, 1890, I was returning from Europe with my Wild West company. When the New York pilot came aboard, he brought a big packet of papers. That was before the days of wireless, and we had had no tidings of what was going on in the world since we had left the other side. As he came up the ladder, he recognized me and shouted, "Colonel, there's a big Indian war started. I guess you'll be needed out there." I seized the papers and eagerly read the details of the threatened outbreak. I was not surprised when, on arriving at quarantine, I was handed a telegram from General Miles. I was requested to come to Chicago as soon as possible, and to telegraph the time of my arrival. Canceling all New York engagements, I caught the first train for the West, and in 36 hours reported to General Miles in his headquarters. He briefly described to me what had been happening, and went over with me the maps of the western states, where the Indians were getting ready for war. He said that it was his understanding that the Badlands of North Dakota had been selected as the battleground by the Indians, and asked me to give him all the information I possessed about that country and its accessibility for troops. Miles was about to leave for the Pine Ridge Agency, and take command of the campaign, to put down the Indians. I was thoroughly familiar with the Badlands, and spent an hour or more in discussing the coming campaign with the general. We both agreed that the Indians had selected a particularly good country for their uprising, and an especially good season, as in winter, with the hills covered with snow, and blizzards of almost daily occurrence, it would be far harder to hunt them out than in summer, when the troops could travel easily. Miles said that Sitting Bull had his camp somewhere within 40 or 50 miles of the Standing Rock Agency, and was haranguing the Indians thereabout, spreading the Messiah talk and getting them to join him. He asked me if I could go immediately to Standing Rock and Fort Yates, and thence to Sitting Bull's camp. He knew that I was an old friend of the chief, and he believed that if anyone could induce the old fox to abandon his plans for a general war, I could. If I could not dissuade him from the warpath, the general was of the opinion that I might be able to delay him in taking it, so the troops could be sent into the country in time to prevent a horrible massacre of the defenseless white settlers, who were already in terror of their lives. I knew that this would be the most dangerous undertaking of my career. I was sure that if I could reach Sitting Bull, he would at least listen to me. But in the present inflamed state of the Indian mind, it would be next to impossible to get to his camp alive. Nevertheless, I was quite ready to take the risk. I knew what fearful damage could be done by a sudden uprising of fanatical and infuriated Indians, and any danger to me personally was as nothing to the importance of preventing such a thing, if possible. Having no standing as an army officer or as a government agent, it was necessary for me to be supplied with some sort of credentials, in order to secure the assistance I should need on my mission. When I informed General Miles of this, he took one of his visiting cards from a case, and wrote the following on the back of it: "To commanding officers of United States troops, furnish Colonel William F. Cody with any assistance or escort that he may ask for. Nelson A. Miles." I took the next train for Manton, ND, which was the station nearest the Standing Rock Agency. There I hired a livery team and driver for the ride of 65 miles to the agency. I had considerable difficulty in securing a driver, as the report had gone abroad that all the Indians were on the warpath, and few of the settlers cared to risk their scalps on such a venture. But I went higher and higher in my offers, till at last a liveryman figured that $100 was sufficient reward for the risk, and, hitching up his team, told me to come along. After an intensely cold drive, we reached the agency, where I hurried into the trader's store to thaw out by his stove. I had hardly arrived before the trader came, and then told me that Major McLaughlin, the Indian agent, wanted to see me. News travels very fast in the Indian country, especially in war times. Someone about the post who had seen me driving in had hurried to headquarters to inform the agent that Buffalo Bill had arrived by way of reinforcements. As soon as I got my chilled blood into circulation, I went to the major's quarters and informed him of the purpose of my visit. We were old friends, and he was very glad to see me, but he was much concerned on learning what I intended to do. "That is impossible," he said. The Sioux are threatening a great war. At this very moment we do not know when the Indians here at the agency may rise. We can take care of our own situation, for we have 4 troops of cavalry here, but we cannot permit you to go to Sitting Bull's camp. Not only would you be killed before you got halfway there, but your presence in the country would precipitate hostilities for which we are not in the least prepared. I'm sorry, Cody, but it can't be done. More fully to persuade me of the truth of what he said, he took me to the quarters of Colonel Brown, the commander of the troops at the agency, and asked him to talk to me. Brown listened to my statement of what I proposed and shook his head. I've heard of you, Cody, and of your nerve, but this is more than even you can do. Sitting Bull's camp is 40 miles away, and the country between here and there is swarming with Indians all ready to go on the warpath, and wholly beyond the sway of reason. I cannot permit you to make this attempt. Do you hear, Cody? Said McLaughlin. The only thing for you to do is to stay all night with us and then return to the railroad. Even that will be risky enough, even for you. But go you must, added Brown. The agency is under martial law, and I cannot permit you to remain any longer than tomorrow morning. There was no arguing with these men. So I resorted to my credentials. Taking General Miles's card from my pocket, I laid it before Colonel Brown. What does this mean? He demanded, and passed the card to McLaughlin. It looks like orders, said McLaughlin. Yes, said Brown, and I can't disobey them. Just then Captain Fauchet, an old friend of mine, came into the quarters, and Brown turned me over to him for entertainment until I should formulate my plans for my visit to Sitting Bull. I had never served with the 8th Cavalry, to which the companies at the post belonged, but I had many friends among the officers, and spent a very pleasant afternoon and evening talking over old times, and getting information about the present situation. After guard mount the next morning I told Colonel Brown that I did not think I would require an escort for my visit, as the presence of a number of armed men in the Indian country would be sure to start the trouble it was our purpose to avoid, or to delay as long as possible. The man who had driven me over was anxious to return at once, so I asked for a light spring wagon and a team of mules. Wait an hour or two, said the colonel, and I'll send the quartermaster to you. I waited, and he employed the time, as I afterward learned, in telegraphing to General Miles, to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, to the Secretary of the Interior, and to President Harrison. He informed all of them that I was there, insisting on going to Sitting Bull's camp, and that such an errand would not only result in my death, but would precipitate the outbreak then brewing, and for which he was not at all prepared. He besought all of them to instruct me to return to Mandan. While he waited for replies to his dispatches, I hunted about the camp for someone who knew just where Sitting Bull was located and how to get there. I also wanted a first-class interpreter, as I would have matters to discuss with Sitting Bull beyond his mastery of English or mine of Sioux to express. At last I found a man, who agreed to go with me as guide for $500, which I promised him without a protest. Then I went over to the post trader's store, and bought all manner of presents, which I knew would be acceptable to Sitting Bull, his squaw, and his children. When I returned to Colonel Brown's quarters, he endeavored once more to put me off. But I would not be put off. I informed him that I had explicit orders from General Miles as to my mission, and that if he interfered with me he was violating the orders of his commanding officer, and running into very serious trouble. At last he reluctantly sent for the quartermaster, and ordered him to have a span of good mules hitched to a light spring wagon. The wagon was driven to the post trader's store, where I found my guide and interpreter, and loaded aboard the presents I had bought for the old warrior. With plenty of robes to keep out the intense cold, we started out on our journey, a little apprehensive, but fully determined to go through with it. 5 or 6 miles from the post we met 3 men in a wagon driving toward the agency. They told us that Sitting Bull's camp had been lately moved, and that it was now further down the river. I knew that if the old man was really on the warpath he would be moving up the river, not down, so I felt considerably reassured. When we had proceeded a few miles further we heard a yell behind us, and, looking back, saw a rider approaching at full speed. This proved to be one of Major McLaughlin's Indian scouts. He bore a telegram reading, "Colonel William F. Cody, Fort Yates, ND, the order for the detention of Sitting Bull has been rescinded. You are hereby ordered to return to Chicago and report to General Miles. Benjamin Harrison, President." That ended my mission to Sitting Bull. I still believe I could have got safely through the country, though there were plenty of chances that I would be killed or wounded in the attempt. I returned to the post, turned back my presents at a loss to myself, and paid the interpreter $50 for his day's work. He was very glad to have the 50 and a whole skin, for he could not figure how the 500 would be of much help to him if he had been stretched out on the plains with an Indian bullet through him. I was supplied with conveyance back to Mandan by Colonel Brown, and took my departure the next morning. Afterward, in Indianapolis, President Harrison informed me that he had allowed himself to be persuaded against my mission in opposition to his own judgment, and said he was very sorry that he had not allowed me to proceed. It developed afterward that the people who had moved the president to interfere consisted of a party of philanthropists, who advanced the argument that my visit would precipitate a war in which Sitting Bull would be killed, and it was to spare the life of this man that I was stopped. The result of the president's order was that the Ghost Dance War followed very shortly, and with it came the death of Sitting Bull. I found that General Miles knew exactly why I had been turned back from my trip to Sitting Bull. But he was a soldier, and made no criticism of the order of a superior. General Miles was glad to hear that I had been made a brigadier general, but he was still more pleased with the fact that I knew so many Indians at the agency. "You can get around among them," he said, "and learn their intentions better than any other man I know." I remained with General Miles until the final surrender of the North American Indians to the United States government after 300 years of warfare. This surrender was made to Miles, then Lieutenant General of the Army, and it was eminently fitting that a man who had so ably conducted the fight of the white race against them, and had dealt with them so justly and honorably, should have received their surrender. With that event ended one of the most picturesque phases of Western life, Indian fighting. It was with it that I was identified from my youth to my middle age, and in the time I spent on the plains, Indian warfare reached its greatest severity and its highest development.